The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Mark Chandler, you are an economist and you have a website, Mark to Market, Mark with a C. And I want to talk about your background later, but the thing that is kind of vexing everybody, obviously, these days is this coronavirus. And of course, we hope everybody stays healthy. But beyond that, what people are trying to figure out now is the economic and earnings impact that this coronavirus is going to have in the U.S. and across the globe. And so I'm very pleased to have you on the podcast to hopefully put into context a little bit what types of things we're seeing economically, how bad the damage you expect to be, how quickly we should rebound or could rebound, and yeah, just your general take on things from an economic perspective.
Sure, well, thanks. Yeah, what a shocker, huh? You know, yeah. Out of all the things that we thought about, like what could hurt us, many people, I mean, the pandemics and these viruses, of course, this is like, they make great Netflix series. Mm. But at the end of the day, I think that I'm hesitant to call it a black swan event, because it's like the third or fourth kind of virus we've gotten in recent years. I think about SARS, I think about MERS. So on one hand, I think we're ill-prepared for this kind of shock, ill-prepared socially, institutionally, and psychologically. I think that this is the real thing. I mean, if we've been saving money for a rainy day, this is a rainy day. This is emergency that we probably haven't seen so much in our lifetimes. I know people talk about some very clearly man-made, and specifically man-made disasters like World War I, World War II. And in our own lifetimes, we think about these other big events, maybe 9/11 here in the U.S. But this, and maybe even some of us still had a scar tissue from the global, from the great financial crisis, 08 and 09. But this is bigger and bigger than these kind of events that we're familiar with. Mm. I think the closest thing probably the Spanish flu, early part of the century. So that's the first thing I'd make is that a lot of people I think are confused because we sort of talk ourselves into this into these like myths. And one of these myths is that the Fed kills economic recoveries and that that's the cause of the last recessions we've had. And when I look at those other recessions, the great financial crisis, the tech bubble, the savings and loan crisis earlier in my career, these were financial crises that led over to an economic crisis, end of a business cycle. But this, what we're dealing with now, this is an economic crisis that's going to spill over and hitting the financial sector. So what we've seen around the world, but also in the U.S., central banks ease monetary policy. So they cut interest rates, buying assets like the QE versions that we saw before. But other countries are doing their own versions of it. And we've got the federal government slowly responding. I think at first the U.S. was very far behind the curve, still in denial. I'd say we were in denial up to about 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. So give me till like March 13th or so. And I think we're getting more serious. And, you know, a couple weeks ago when Congress was proposing about an $8 billion spending package, it was criticized for having a lot of ideological goodies in it. And now, as of this morning, The White House, through Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, is talking about an $850 billion package. Mm. So this is like we're going on to war footing.
Mm. Okay. And do you think this – it sounds like you think this response is appropriate by policymakers and by central banks. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I don't always think that they're very slow. Mm. And that what they're doing is they're going to things like, for example, the Federal Reserve increasing its repo operations. Yeah. They've gone from like very small to $500 billion offering at a time. And it turns out the market doesn't need that much. It doesn't want that much. And so there's an attempt to shock and awe and maybe not get the money directly to people themselves. And there's some talk now of like a universal basic income, like right. a one-off check. Cut to all adults, say, $1,000 to get money into people's hands directly. And it's the same problem with some of these other operations that the banks still intermediate. So the Federal Reserve or government might give large institutions access to capital, but then people have to borrow it from these institutions, and these other institutions might have other thoughts to do with their money.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that people can't really go out and spend money even if they wanted to, seeing how all restaurants, bars, and retail outlets are effectively closed. I suppose they could order things online, but one would think that the outcome would maybe not be quite what was desired, especially when you look at small and local businesses, right? A lot of these individually owned businesses, these mom and pop little places that you walk into off the street in towns and cities across the country, across the world, not to mention the gig economy and the workers in that sector. But all that aside, so as far as an economic shock to the system, you mentioned historic parallels, and I'm apt to agree that this is a little bit different than the other cycles that we've seen in our lifetime, at least. This is something that was caused by an exogenous shock. Prior to this, the economy, at least in the U.S., if you believe the economists, and if you go beyond that and you look at all the data, was seemingly healthy. You know, you had unemployment at very low levels. You had manufacturing was doing okay. Consumption was fine. Housing, pretty good. And this after 10 years of expansion. So what do you make of the argument that this was an exogenous shock, the underlying economy is still in good shape, and that once this thing is clear and everybody goes back to work, we'll have a nice one of these V-shaped recoveries, right, where things just kind of like bounce right away. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, I know. I grew up in Chicago. I'm a Cubs fan.
And okay, well, say no more. Yeah. But hey, you guys won the World Series too, finally. So
of course, yeah, but I think there is like a sense of optimism. You know, I think that there's some good reason to be optimistic. And here's how I sort of look at it. You know, I did some work at a master's degree in American history, and I know in the beginning of the Civil War, the North was very slow to get going, to get onto war footing. But when it got on war footing, it really, you know, the wheels turned quite strongly. Same thing about World War II. U.S. a bit slow. We got the industry in the war effort, and there was no turning back. Same thing with the space race. The Soviet Union was actually ahead of the U.S. for a while. And I think that, so for me, that's the important thing that's going to happen is that finally, and I think belatedly, the wheels, which by, I mean, the U.S. machinery, industry, government, the central bank, everybody is going to be wheeling together. And when those wheels begin turning, I think we're going to see all kinds of things. Like today, for example, the first vaccination for humans is being tested in Seattle. And so, of course, we got to get our own way in the regulations and everything that prevent this from coming to the market very quickly. But I just think about the virtue of the United States, the decentralization, which means that every state has a state university, and almost every state university has a hospital, and these hospitals have researchers. Decentralized, you got a lot of brain power behind this. And so I know this might sound to some of your international viewers as like this is a typical American. Like technological optimism. And there is an element there. But, you know, when it comes to selling books online, maybe there's a first mover advantage. But when it comes to fighting this COVID-19, maybe the sort of the last one as an advantage. And by that, I don't mean, of course, we haven't seen the whole world get it yet. Africa's only beginning. Mm. But it looks like the U.S. is behind Asia by maybe more than a month, behind Europe by a couple of weeks. And so maybe this is going to give us slow to start. We have our own challenges here, number of hospital beds per 100,000 people and doctors and all those kind of things. But I do think that the wheels are going to be getting turning. They're slow to come out of the block, but they are moving. And so I think that there's good reason to be optimistic that just like the markets overshot on the upside. And I'm kind of one of those people that thought that almost any measure of valuation that I'm familiar with showed the market was like just outrageously expensive. And now maybe the market's gotten outrageously cheap. And maybe it's going to have to get cheaper before. I mean, I know some people are looking at it to say, I think we dipped below that 19,000 in the Dow today. You know, the kind of downturn we're expecting is really going to be a couple things. One, it's going to be compressing earnings. And so we investors have to make that adjustment. But sometimes the markets get it wrong. But I think that the markets are a huge aggregator of information. And right now, the information it needs to aggregate, it's not quite there. And some of the things we need is when will this peak? Does one become immune to it after one gets it? What happens when Chinese economy is going back, people are going back to work. You can see that traffic's going up, pollution is going up again. What happens if there's another outbreak of the virus? And so, and same thing like with the Spanish flu, they pushed it back. The spring, summer months, you saw less transmission of it, and then it comes roaring back that next winter. And so I think my sense would be that interest rates are going to have to stay low for the rest of this year. If we do get the V-shaped recovery in the economy, is it just a one quarter and a pent-up demand to go out to drinking or buying some goods? Like you say, this has been a historically long expansion. A lot of pent-up demand was already been spent. So I think that maybe you get this one quarter big bounce back. But what is the growth potential in the U.S. economy? And so growth potential, we think of it as like how many working age people you have who are employed and what's the productivity. And so I think that that's sort of like the speed limit of the economy. You look at the speed limit, then you can, of course, put some high octane fuel in it called fiscal stimulus or other measures. But what is the speed limit of the economy? And it really has a lot to do with the population growth and workforce growth, because productivity tends to be it doesn't change all that much from quarter to quarter, though it can change over a period of time. So bottom line here, you get population growth of about 1%, you have productivity of about 1%. I think the speed limit then is around 2%.
So what camp would you say that you're in from an economic perspective? Are you in the camp of the V-shape? Or do you think that this is going to be much more profound and longer lasting and have wider ranging effects than people are maybe accounting for right now?
Yeah, sure. No, that's a good question. I do think that we get a little V-shaped recovery. So Q3 or Q4 should be very strong. But I'm also in the camp that says that there are some serious like distributional issues in the U.S. that are going to limit growth. That even if we have this a strong bounce back in the economy, we still have there are going to be some fundamental changes to how we do business. I think that people are discovering a freedom. I think the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says about 30 million Americans can work from home. And I think some of us for some people, it's a new experience. I think they see a freedom and maybe even a boost in productivity because you got to cut out that commute time. So I think one of the other things I think that especially for people who are looking at the markets, one of the things I think will come from this is that money itself, the coins and notes we keep in our pocket, this is like a contagious vehicle. And I think that it will help accelerate the move to I'm not talking about the cyber currencies like bitcoins. I'm talking about the digital currencies that central banks will come out with. And I think you'll see China really taking a lead on this. They already have a lot of patents. They're already moving in that direction. I think this will accelerate that move to official digital currencies.
Do you even need that, though? Because all the electronic commerce that happens now, you can do anything with your credit card. I mean, even here in the U.S., which, by the way, is far behind Asia when it comes to point of sale transactions with these credit cards, if you've ever been to China or other parts of Asia. But even still, you can still use your credit card. And, here in New York, you go into Bodega, you can use it. Sometimes they try to make you charge at least $5 or something. Or I went into one the other day and they said there was no minimum, but they charged me 50 cents because I was only buying two things or something. But the point is that you can make these, you can use this now. You don't even really need cash. And also further to that, I saw a tweet just yesterday, I think, that somebody was talking about how she had gone into a store and they said, no more cash, only credit cards. And you know, she was very concerned about this, and I replied to her and I said, well, to be honest with you, I'd be more concerned if it was the other way around, because you know, as long as we can use our credit cards and as long as all that infrastructure is still working, where you can process things, you can pay for things online, you can pay for things, we can't go into stores anymore, but on the delivery apps, right? Everything should kind of keep humming. Whereas once that shuts down and you need cash, you've got bigger problems, right?
So. Yeah. So for me, though, the problem with the credit cards is that they're not a utility. Right. Businesses pay a few percentage points.
Right.
And the other problem is ultimately it's based on a bank.
Right.
Having a bank. And so we want to create a digital currency. But I think to your point, though, China's really done it through a mobile apps.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to find an American way to do it because so many people are not banked and are relatively new to that. But I fully agree with you that so with looking at really what are going to be the changes on the other side of this crisis? And I think one of those changes is moving, whether it's more like your idea of a greater reliance on credit cards or figuring out maybe – I think that like the thinking has to progress where, you know, during the in the 19th century, early 20th century, what were utilities? They were the electricity, water, gas coming into your house. Maybe in this new age, maybe there's other things that are utilities. Like access to like a credit or debit card. Maybe it has to be that the central bank has to keep the account instead of the local bank. So that really redefines the purpose of banks, right? Mm. Banks have a utility function and they have a casino function.
Mm.
And let the investors deal with the casino function. Maybe the utility function should be taken away from them.
Mm.
So like the postal savings, like they do in Japan. So
yeah.
I can see a lot of things. I guess my point really is that yes, this is probably a short-term shock, major shock to the global economy. But there are some things that probably going forward are going to change society. So this becomes one of those before and after moments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, Mark Chandler, I want to come back and ask you some more about your background and some more ideas for investors going forward. But let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, welcome back. Mark Chandler, this is the section of the podcast where we like to introduce our guest a little bit more closely and have him or her describe his or her background to listeners and tell us basically where they've come from and how they came out to be this this stage of their careers, I guess. So why don't you take it away and tell us about that?
Yeah, so I guess my background is very surprising to many people. Maybe the most interesting thing is I grew up in Chicago, but my family made the exodus to the suburbs, and I was always very politically aware. And I organized a strike in high school and got kicked out of high school. So even though I have two master's degrees, I don't have a high school diploma.
Okay.
And I guess this kind of experience is really like a critical, I think, for the kind of mind that you want for someone like my job as a strategist, having to doubt everything, be skeptical. I tease like that you should only believe like nothing that you see and only or you should believe like nothing you hear and only half of what you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so a very skeptical mind, especially skeptical about authority. And authority doesn't just mean the government, but it means any concentration of power. And so I also, right around the same time I got kicked out of high school, and this also illustrates another thing about my who I am, is I was working, I come from a lower middle class background, and I had to work in high school, and I was working at a Burger King, and lost that job because I tried to unionize it. And as you probably know, there's no unionization. While other countries have unionization in fast foods, Americans don't. And I lost that battle, and I ended up having to. I worked at a frozen an ice cream and frozen yogurt shop.
Did you try to unionize them too? No, or?
Too small. Okay. But I ended up. I hadn't really thought it thoroughly out, and it turned out that like I didn't have a clue what I was going to do that winter. The ice cream shop closes down, Chicago. So I ended up going to Burger King and promising I wouldn't cause union trouble again. So I go out to college, and it's funny, a lot of colleges will accept students who, you know, you have to take the ACT test or the SAT test. You have to have your head on straight to some extent, but you don't need a high school diploma to get to a lot of colleges, universities, especially these days where they where it's really more on ability than like you have the sheepskin. So, anyways, I have a background undergraduate and in a graduate school. I studied what I thought were the social sciences. That's really what I wanted, to study people, how they think, and from people from whether it's anthropology, sociology. But I really tended to undergraduate. I focused on political science. At the school, North Central, just in DeKalb, in North Central, is in Naperville, Illinois, outside of Chicago. I have two majors. One was political science, and the other was what they called humanities, religion, history, philosophy. And I was turned down from a teacher who still is a professor now. He teaches at Rutgers now in American history. And I liked it so much, I studied with his professors. I went to Northern Illinois in DeKalb to get a master's in American history. And I really focused on two things. One was Frederick Douglass, who was a slave. And the challenge is, how do you fight a system that's backed by law? In the sense that slavery, it took three amendments to the Constitution to get rid of slavery. Mm-hmm. So how do you fight a system that has the authority of the law behind it? Because I thought in my own mind, that's what I was going to have to do. And then studying American history naturally took me into modern foreign policy. America like was born in the age of empire and always sort of fancied itself as an empire itself of some sort. And so I studied American foreign policy, and it naturally took me into international relations, where I did another master's degree in what I thought was political economy. And I had thought that's what the original thinkers like about capitalism, like Adam Smith. Political economy. So I looked around at the time, this is early 80s, and what school has a good program in international relations? Political economy. Well, it turned out the two schools did. One was Princeton, the Woodrow Wilson School, and the other was the University of Pittsburgh, the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. I, of course, applied to both of them. And the for Princeton, the Woodrow Wilson School, you had to write a policy paper. And again, what would my policy paper be? It was why Brazil should declare a unilateral moratorium on their debt. Mm. A very unpopular. I don't know if the topic, my point of view, or it might be my writing ability, kept me back. I wasn't accepted at Princeton. And so I went to the University of Pittsburgh. And lo and behold, what they thought of political economy was how politics screws up the economy. Hmm. It was like libertarianism slash classical liberalism, minimal state, governments only screw things up. So when I got out of school, then two master's degrees, I knew what unemployment was, but I didn't know what it meant for like the markets. And so the one thing I could do, I thought, was write. I used to write for underground newspapers. Then I got incorporated in school newspapers. I used to write this column called For the Dissent. From the Supreme Court, and it'd always be like finding something to like hold up what might be good against what's perfect. And so I found a job looking through the newspapers. I didn't know people in the industry or anything like that, but for me, I already appreciated how the currency markets. The dollar was in the middle of a huge rally when I got out of graduate school, so I had this job at the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange as a reporter, covering the currency futures and T-bill Eurodollar futures. And occasionally I'd have to, like, this was the first set of computers, too, Radio Shack TRS-80s. Mm. You had a small screen, and I used to have a phone hookup cradle. You had to put the handheld phone into this cradle to make sure it got to the signal to send it to my editor. So I did that for a few years, and then I realized about why the markets, how the markets really work. The markets reward people that have an opinion. You don't have to be right. You need an opinion. You need to have some way to synthesize the news, and what does this mean? So to answer the question about what does this mean, or why is this important, or what should I do? And so I became an analyst at Dean Witter Reynolds at the time, before it was bought by Morgan Stanley. And then I did a stint at a hedge fund for a while that blew up when the Europeans widened out the currency ranges to 6%. And then I did a whole thing for a bunch of large banks, Deutsche Bank, HSBC. And I spent the last 13, 14 years at Brown Brothers Harriman, an old-fashioned partnership bank, value investing. They acted the custodian as their function. That's how I got involved, a custodian being the back office for a lot of mutual funds and asset managers who needed to make the currency transactions. People are like, you might have a 401k, you have some money in a Fidelity bond fund or a Matthews Asian fund. So Brown Brothers would sort of act as a custodian for this and do the currency transactions. So I was able to deal with, in my career, the largest S&P 500 companies, the largest asset managers. But for me, the problem was, and this is, I think, a challenge for many people in their careers now, is that progress, technological progress, means that couple things. It means that a lot of the large asset managers have artificial intelligence. They're using algorithms to execute their trades. People like us who are bringing money to the asset managers. We see the problem with the equity fund managers, the active fund managers, and many of us are choosing passive indexed funds. So these people needed less people like me. I was able to add less value, and I'm still committed to adding value when I can. And so I joined this boutique about a year and a half ago, a Bannockburn Global Forex. Small group of people, offices. There's like 1- and 2-person offices throughout the country. And instead of helping the large asset managers and the wholesale market, the institutions, Bannockburn really helps the small, medium-sized businesses. And I can add a lot more value to them. And it's much more challenging. It's sort of like David Goliath stories. I'll give you an example. These large asset managers and the large companies, they buy foreign exchange. The price of foreign exchange is the spread between the bid and the offer. And these clients, the largest players in the market, you look at your screen, there's four places on the other side of the decimal point. Well, there's really a fifth one for the wholesale market. What small and medium-sized businesses are paying. So we're talking about, for these large businesses, then we're talking about a thousandth of a penny spread between the bid and the offer. The small and medium-sized businesses I'm talking to these days, they're paying 3%, sometimes 4%, because they're treated like there's a wholesale and a retail price for money. And I spent most of my career on the wholesale side, and now I'm trying to help retail get those institutional capabilities, institutional pricing, institutional analysis. And so I'm finding a sort of late in career, finding new ways to add value.
Interesting. Yeah, and speaking on podcasts is certainly one. And people with your background, a diverse set of educational and professional experiences, and having that rebellious streak especially, is something that I very much look for when I'm having people on the show, to kind of, as the name suggests, present a contrarian view, right? So what is something that you think that we're all missing here in the market and economies? We talked before about how this is a big event, obviously. You go back through your history. I mean, it's pretty funny at the outset of this thing, maybe not funny, but everyone was saying, well, this is an exogenous shock. The economy is in okay shape. And that's true, but World War I was also an exogenous shock, right? And that changed everything, right? I mean, in 1914, you had kings and queens running around Europe, right? And that was all overthrown pretty much, and at least in Germany and Russia, et cetera. But you had countries created out of nothing. You had all kinds, women's right to vote. That changed everything. The whole colonial system was wasn't ended then, but it was certainly kind of put on life support. And then World War II pretty much ended it. But the point is that we have these major events in our lives. 9/11, people said, was going to be one. In certain ways it was, You can't fly like you did before 9/11. What other types of things? And this gets us maybe off track a little bit and more into the realm of society. But nevertheless, I do think we should address it. What types of changes do you think might be coming down here and what might be created as a result of this whole corona crisis?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Now, you know, during the great financial crisis, Bernanke said something like, said something to the effect like, there's no atheists in a foxhole.
Yeah, right.
There's no ideologues in a crisis. And I think that this public health crisis reveals in a very profound way the problems with the minimal government, the libertarian type of point of view here. And I think it's like, you know, for many years we've been saying, you know, as a country in the U.S., the emphasis on individualism, civic responsibility, civic duty, this seems to be like sucker's payout. Like you try to get out of jury duty, you look out for yourself. And I think that a crisis like this makes us, I mean, I think those kind of things leave us ill-prepared for this kind of crisis. We've like really dissolved social trust. Language has been debased. And I think that it cost us as a society our ability, our resilience. And so I hear you that like you buy a good stock and bad things happen and the stock's going to sell off. You do the right thing, and sometimes you still get punished. Mm-hmm. But I think what happens is that you buy like a value, something that you could, you buy something of value, and it might still get hit. But we're not talking about sort of like what they talk about when you're getting in a boxing match or something. Not how much of a, it's not like how hard you could hit. It's how hard of a punch you could take and still come back up. How resilient you are. And I'm afraid that for me, I think that's one of the things that have come from this is that this minimal state. What are those people called who are like not political appointees? They're just like bureaucrats who do their job. Are they really the deep state? Is this who we have to like demonize? Is the biggest threat to America really the Federal Reserve? Is it really? And so I say one of the things that are going to have to change, I think, in order for us to be more resilient, is that some kind of sense of civic duty or civic responsibility. The idea of these, you see in these pictures on the social media, people say 25 or so, going to the bar still, thinking that they're like immune, that this is some kind of boomer remover. No social responsibility. And I think the same thing for, I mean, it's not just like, I don't want to just say millennials and that, but I think that we've eroded the sense of community. And a lot of different, it's not like one thing has caused it, but a lot of different forces. I think about Robert Putnam's book, Why We Bowl Alone. Like what happened in the 50s and 60s, people belonged to a lot of these bowling leagues. And now we don't anymore. What's happening? And I see someone else, you know, I see you got the headphones on. And I sometimes make a mental count when I'm in the subway. How many people in my subway car have headphones on? And it didn't really, it's just kind of ironic. It seems to me like part of modernity is that you can right. It's like in my book called Political Economy of Tomorrow, I talk about this as custom made but mass produced.
Right.
Mass produced music, but we can custom make the songs we want to listen to. We can watch the shows we want to watch. Everything can be like individualized. Though we get all the benefits of being mass produced as far as costs and everything. And so maybe this. This COVID-19 crisis just shows us the extent of which this atomization of society has other consequences when we have to deal with group problems. Mm. But the other thing I was going to say about the market economy itself is that I put it like this, that, you know, oftentimes I find in my reading and talking with people that they see some problem with the market economy. 19th century, you couldn't have capitalism. Slavery was so important for industrial capitalism, you couldn't have capitalism without slavery. And then if women got to vote, there goes the household. And we're told like for a while, you know, when people were much younger, say 30, 40 years ago when we were kids, you could used to go swimming in the Hudson River in New York, and then a large company polluted it. And we still pay that price for that. And the idea was, well, you had to pollute because otherwise, if you were green, you couldn't make any money.
Right.
And now I think that we've seen that capitalism has this resilience, that the problems that people point to can be addressed. The problem I see is that sort of like maybe some people you know, some people I know, their biggest weakness comes out of their biggest strength. It can't just be reformed away. It's a much more nuanced type of problem. And I'd say that about capitalism. I think that we've reached a stage in capitalism where I think it's like the Midas, like King Midas from Greek mythology. Everything we touch turns to gold. We are wealthier beyond our imaginations. And we have so much money, we don't know what to do with it all. So we look for create new assets like Bitcoins to absorb some of this, like a carbon trap. I think that capitalism has produced a surplus. You know, people these days, when you think about like things like high cholesterol, heart disease, what are these caused by? It's caused by too much of a good thing. Most of our problems seem to me to be too much of a good thing. Pollution, the rapid melting of the equator, Antarctica, and the snow caps. What is happening is too much of a good thing. Too many cars, too much carbon dioxide. And so I worry that this age that we're in is one of surplus. And the most troubling surplus is that of capital. Before the crisis hit, we're looking at something like $15 trillion or so of negative yielding bonds. Nice. There's a story about this, when pork prices jumped in China, there's a story about a guy who's taking a half a pig home to his family on the back, he was riding his motorcycle, had a half a pig, and he was hijacked. And the hijackers let him keep the motorcycle. Right? So we live in this world of incredible surplus. And when things are not in surplus, or when things are in surplus, we understand it, right? The price of oil has dropped because there's a lot more supply than demand. Well, there's nothing special about money. Money operates, I think, the same way. The reason that we have negative interest rates or so low of interest rates is not because the central banks are buying up bonds or this or that. The reason that we have low interest rates is partly because growth is low, growth potential is low, inflation is low, but ultimately because we have too much money. Too much money that wants this zero, that wants to have safety over investment.
But then wouldn't higher interest rates kind of be a solution to that? Because if you put the right, if you increase the savings rate and you give people reason to save money versus spend it and circulate it out there, wouldn't that be a way to deal with it?
Yeah, so the higher interest rates to like lock that money up, like another carbon trap, like lock that money up so it's not in the realm of circulation. We can do things like that, but it's not like it adds stuff. So what happens is the banks then have more money, and what do they do with that money? They use that then to speculate. Mm-hmm. They leverage that. I'm not sure that like boosting savings rate. I think like boosting consumption for people there's so many people and I think it was like 30% of Americans don't have like $400 in the bank.
Yeah.
We want them to be consuming like you or me might.
Mm-hmm. Right. The one other thing here is that you seem to when it comes to the central banks, and I'm not going to be one of these people who says we should abolish the Fed and go back to a gold standard and do all that. But on some level, you have to see, especially if you go back into the recent economic history here, and you look at what, starting with the Greenspan Fed and how they flooded money in the early 2000s to respond to 9/11 and then kept interest rates way too low for way too long, which created the housing bubble. And then the Bernanke came in and started to raise rates gradually, and that caused the bubble to burst. And then you had the great financial crisis. And then you had QE, QE2, QE infinity, which then created this 10-year everything bubble, one could say. And now you're back to zero again after these latest cuts. On some level, couldn't you make the argument that this is all created by central bank missteps, starting with the Greenspan Fed, and that there should perhaps be some level of accountability of the Fed to the voters? The central bank, we call it a central bank, and it effectively is, but as you know, this wasn't created until 1914 or 1915, right? And there was a need to do this at the time, right? Because you kept having these bank runs and stuff. But nevertheless, there's not really anything in the Constitution for this. And the Fed kind of operates as its own little thing. It's funded actually by the banks, right? As you know, it's not funded by taxpayers. That's something that people get wrong quite a bit. So on some level, there's like a First, the fact that they have misstepped over the last 20 years, and then also the fact that, yeah, that they're not really accountable as a government body, and maybe they should be, and maybe there should be a way for voters to vote out the chairman or something like that. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there, but some level of accountability, right? I mean, what do you think of all that?
Yeah, no, I think you raise a good point. I think this is very much like, for me, like very true to the American, like, or America's contribution to political philosophy.
Right.
And that is distrust. So Europeans would say something like, I think it was Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Right.
But I think the American version of it is power corrupts, so let's hold it, let's democratize it and hold it accountable.
Right.
And I think that's the American answer. It's much more pragmatic. On the other hand, there are parts of the government that are not so answerable to voters directly. And important branches, I think about the Supreme Court. When the Constitution was written, even senators were not elected by people, but were elected by state houses.
Yep.
And so I think that for me, I'd say that the way that the central bank works in our society is its job is really to look out for the system as a whole. To make sure the system as a whole for capitalism, it's not socialism by any means. They want to make sure capitalism works out, not for any individual capitalist industry or capitalist person, but for the capitalist as a whole. And that really requires some work in the financial, sort of financial space rather than the direct economy. So they're really for the banks, money supply, and interest rates. To your point, I think that if you ask me, has the Fed made mistakes? I'd say sure. Does private sector make mistakes? Sure. Is there any way to avoid this? Probably not. How to make the central bank more accountable? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the best way to make it accountable. I think that things like that we have in other things, term limits, perhaps three 6-year terms was maybe too much for Mr. Greenspan. One term was too small for Yellen. I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, so maybe some term limits to reach your point about accountability. I'm not sure how to do it. I mean, part of the problem is that in other countries, I can't think of a central bank that is directly accountable. But I could see how you could have, and there's supposed to be someone, a board of governor, who's supposed to be representing the interest of community banks.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So I can see there's ways to like get it more representative. Mm-hmm. Without necessarily letting people vote on the next chairman, chairperson.
Or maybe you have something else. I mean, the president right now appoints the Fed president, right? I don't know anything about that, and I probably should know more about how the governors are appointed, and you have all these local feds, right?
So, essentially the governors are all appointed by the president with the approval of the Senate. But the local banks sort of they rise up through the local bank or the local bank, like the New York Fed or the St. Louis Fed. They'll pick one of their own or someone who they want on a local level. The president, I think, tends to be approved by the FOMC. I'm not sure if that's a law or not, but I think that typically, and that's why I like to say the New York Fed is so important, because that's the Fed's execution desk, and the chair, the head of the New York Fed sometimes can go to the Fed or be the chairman of the Fed.
Right. Yeah, and probably making them directly accountable to voters is perhaps completely insane, but just because of the level of knowledge they need to have. But you know, right now it's tied so closely to the executive branch, right? To the president, and you know, the Supreme Court vote works like that. But maybe there's another way to do. Maybe there's a Senate Banking Committee. I don't know. But you know, maybe not. Maybe it works fine. Maybe it's like you said, just some trimming around the edges.
Yeah. No, but it is true that they've tried to do other things to try to make him accountable, like having the chairman obligated to give
the press conferences.
Twice a year to the testify before Congress. But even the press conferences, to your point, it was incredible. For years, other central banks would have press conferences, and this is so for me. Like when they say no credit should go wasted, I think it's one of the things we get is like you pointed about a women's right to vote and things. I think when we have a big crisis, we extend the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam was a crisis for American society. Extend the franchise. I want, in my book, This Political Economy of Tomorrow, I try to anticipate the extension of the franchise. Who would it go to? 16-year-olds. Lower the age by 2 years. Here's why. They did that in Scotland for the referendum, because a lot of important issues are about the future. And I know you say, well, 16-year-olds, they're not mature enough. Same thing people said about 18-year-olds, but also 16-year-olds, they're not going to vote in high numbers.
Yeah, but if that's the case, why don't we just make it 12-year-olds? They're not going to vote in high numbers either, right?
I mean, yeah. I think that you could say that 16-year-olds, the government says you can, you're at an age in which you're allowed to drive a killing machine called a car.
Yeah.
That 16-year-olds sort of a sign of an age of maturity or something like that. So what I see happening is that's why I say the Scottish referendum, because it was about the future. 16-year-olds got the right to vote. And in some states, in some U.S. primaries, 17-year-olds get the right to vote in the primaries, even if they can't vote in the general election. So I think we should be trying to think creatively, but extending the franchise, taking advantage of this crisis, while officials sort of they know that we sort of have an agreement, the same way that Chinese people do, that the leaders have to deliver the goods.
Right.
That's a rising living standard, so that our children live better than we do. But that dream is being lost, and I think the political and economic elite know that. And so they have to buy us, and bread and circuses don't count now. Extend the franchise. Even the White House right now is talking about a version of UBI, that universal basic income, sending every adult $1,000 or something like that. This is an incredible time we're going through. Those old ideological holds don't work. And so I'm hopeful that out of this crisis comes new civil liberties.
That's a nice way to end. Mark, in closing, why don't you just let our listeners know where they can find you on the line and elsewhere?
Sure. So I have a blog you mentioned, Mark to Market. I update that 6 days a week, at least once a day. And it's an institutional level analysis that I'm providing to our clients as well. And I'm also on Twitter in terms of social media called Mark Making Sense. I know it sounds kind of egomaniac, but
that's all right.
My first book was called Making Sense of the Dollar. And I had a young woman working for me, Margaret Kepner, who was brilliant, well ahead of her time, knowing how important the social media was going to be. And she hooked me up. So we wanted to have some marketing. So Mark Making Sense, at Mark Making Sense on Twitter. So feel free. I'm on LinkedIn as well. And I like having dialogues with people. That's how I learned. And I don't know, I think it's sort of like what Mark Twain said. Thomas Edison. He said he didn't fail. He found 10,000 ways it didn't work. And so I think that's some of us who've been around the markets a long time, gray hair, a lot of scar tissue, but happy to learn new things.
Very good. Okay, wonderful. Well, that's a good way of closing. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.